today to speak, or waited for someone else to say the words for me. And I began to recognize a source of power within myself that comes from the knowledge that while it is, of course, most desirable not to be afraid, learning to put fear into a perspective gave me a great strength. I was going to die, if not sooner, then later, whether or not I had ever spoken. My silences had not protected me. Your silence will not protect you. But for every real word I had ever spoken, for every attempt I had ever made to speak those truths for which I am still seeking, I had made contact with other women while we examined the words to fit a world in which we all believed, bridging our differences. And it was the concern and caring of all those women that gave me strength and enabled me to scrutinize the essentials of my life. The women who sustained me through that period were black and white, old and young, lesbian, bisexual, heterosexual, and we all shared a war against the tyranny of silence. They all gave me a strength and a concern without which I could not have survived intact. Within those weeks of acute fear came the knowledge that within the war we are all waging with the forces of death, subtle and otherwise, conscious or not, I am not only a casualty, I am a warrior. What are the words you do not yet have? What is it that you need to say? What are the tyrannies that you swallow day after day and attempt to make your own until you will sicken and die of them eventually, still in silence? Perhaps for some of you here now, I am the face of one of your fears, because I am woman, because I am black, because I am lesbian, because I am myself, a black woman, warrior poet, doing her work, come to ask you, are you doing yours? And of course I am afraid, you can hear it in my voice or not, because the transformation of silence into language and action is an act of self-revelation, always. And that very frequently seems fraught with danger. But it is the weapon, the fear is a weapon used to encourage our silence, and we give in to it every time we are needed. My daughter, when I told her of our topic and my difficulty with it, said, "Hey, why don't you tell them about how you're never really a whole person if you remain silent, because there's always that one little piece inside of you that wants to be spoken out. And if you keep ignoring it, it gets madder and madder and hotter and hotter, and if you don't speak it out, one day it will just up and punch you in the mouth." She's 14. In the cause of silence, each one of us draws the face of her own fear, of contempt, of censure, of some judgment, of recognition, of challenge, of annihilation. But most of all, I think, we fear that very visibility without which we also cannot truly live. Within this country, where racial difference creates a constant, if unspoken, distortion of vision, black women have, on one hand, always been highly visible. And so, on the other hand, we have been rendered invisible through the depersonalization of racism. And yet, even within the women's movement, we have had to fight, and still do, for that very visibility which also renders us most vulnerable, our blackness. For to survive in the mouth of this dragon we call America, we have had to learn this first and most vital lesson, that we were never meant to survive, not as human beings, And I tell you, for most of you here right now, neither were you, black or not. That visibility which makes us most vulnerable is that which is also the source of our greatest strength. Because make no mistake, the machine will try to grind you into dust anyway, visible or not, silence or no. And we are going to be afraid anyway, whether or not we speak. We can sit in our corners mute forever, while our sisters and ourselves are wasted, while our children are distorted and destroyed, while our earth is being poisoned. We can sit in our safe corners, or our offices, or our homes, or wherever, mute as bottles, and we will still be no less afraid. In my house this year, we are celebrating the Feast of Kwanzaa, the African-American festival of harvest, which begins the day after Christmas and runs for 7 days. There are 7 principles of Kwanzaa, 1 for each day. The first principle is umoja, which means unity, the decision to strive for and maintain unity in self and community. The principle for yesterday, which was the second day of Kwanzaa, is kuchichagulia, self-determination. The decision to define ourselves, name ourselves, and speak for ourselves instead of being defined and spoken for by others. Today is the third day of Kwanzaa. The principle for today is ujima, collective work and responsibility. That decision to build and maintain ourselves and our communities and to recognize and solve those problems that we share together. Each one of us here is here because in one way or another we share a commitment to language and to the power of language and to the reclaiming of that language which has been made work against us. In the transformation of silence into language and action, it is vitally necessary, I believe, for each one of us to establish or examine her function in that transformation and to recognize her role as vital within that transformation. For those of us who write, to scrutinize not only the truths of what we speak, but the truth and validity of that language by which we speak it. For others, to share and spread also those words that are meaningful to us. But primarily, and for us all, it is necessary to teach by living and speaking those truths which we believe and know beyond understanding. Because in this way alone, we can survive. Our visions can survive by taking part in a process of life that is creative and continuing, that is growth. It is not without fear of visibility, of the harsh light of scrutiny and perhaps judgment, of pain, of death, but we have lived through all of these already in silence, all except death. And I remind myself now, all the time, that if I were to have been born mute and had maintained an oath of silence my whole life long for safety, I would still have suffered and I would still die. And it's very good for maintaining a perspective on fear. Where the words of women are crying to be heard, we each of us must recognize our responsibility to seek those words out, to read them and share them and examine them in their pertinence to our living, that we not hide behind the mockeries of separations that have been imposed upon us and which so often we accept as our own. For instance, I can't possibly teach black women's writings, their experience is so different from mine. Yet how many years have you spent teaching Plato and Shakespeare and Proust? Or another, she's a white woman and what could she possibly have to say to me? Or, she's a lesbian, what would my husband think or my chairman say if he sees my book list? Or, again, this woman writes of her sons and I have no children. And all the other endless ways in which we rob ourselves of ourselves and each other. We can learn to work and speak when we are afraid, in the same way we have learned to work and speak when we are tired. For we have been socialized to respect fear far more than our own needs for language and definition. And while we wait in silence for that final luxury, that epiphany of fearlessness, the silence will choke us to death. The fact that we are here and that I speak even now these words are an attempt to break that silence and bridge some of those differences between us. For it is not difference that immobilizes us, but silence. And there are so many silences to be broken.
My next speaker is Judith McDale.
What struck me as I read the book profoundly, finally,
story was not what was said, but its silences. Where can we hear or learn what satisfaction Ruth and Naomi found in their life together? What was Ruth thinking as she lay on the cold, hard floor wrapped around that man's feet? Did it mean anything to her that she was the great-grandmother of King David? And I wanted to know, how did she love Naomi? And when she died, did she feel her life had been a full one? The old stories, the stories that name us and tell us how we can live our lives, the old stories are filled with such silences. And yes, we can, and we are, rewriting these stories. Lesbians are rewriting the story of Ruth and Naomi, thank heaven. I know that there are other possibilities for their life, for the life they might have had together. And these possibilities, as we write and think about them, will become realities. But naming, self-defining, I believe, is more than just renaming. To break the silence about our lives as lesbians ultimately means to have access to a part of ourselves that is not even conscious. Access to an inner reality that defines and limits us. It is a part of ourselves that is incorporated in the old story, and most often it lies beyond our conscious will. How do we change this inner sensor, or how is it changed? For change it we must, and this necessity seems to me more and more urgent. We know the oppressor out there. We each know the identity of the man in whose fields we toil, and what we pay to him for our very survival. But to know the limitations that come from within us, that seems to me an even more difficult task. For first, we must conceptualize it, and then we must speak it aloud. One primitive method of conceptualization for me has been my dream life. I threatened that dream the other day. I said, I'm going to tell you my dream. I was thinking particularly of a line from a snapshot of a daughter-in-law, thinking woman sleeps with monsters. And I've been sleeping with quite a few of them recently. If I listen very carefully, sometimes they take on conceptualization. Some of them are funny. I won't tell you my tooth dream, my vagina dentata dream. I woke up saying, oh no, vagina dentata, what next? I won't tell you my nightmares because I know each of you has had them. Those are dreams that I have over and over in times of stress. They are most often how I recognize that I am in a time of stress. But some of the dreams are more complicated, and some of them give me, as I think about them, a conceptualization of a problem that I had not had before. And I wanted to give you just one example. I know other people's dreams are sometimes boring, but this one, this one I like. I once dreamed that I was reading a book, a large old manuscript with parchment-like pages, and then as I turned the page, a warrior goddess sprang out from between them. The power of words, you see. She was dressed in ancient armor, and so was I noticed with no surprise whatever. We faced each other and prepared to fight, never asking why or what about. It seemed enough that we were warriors. Much clashing of swords, and then this. She stood behind me and released a dozen snakes that went into my skull. I became captive immediately, felt my skill and intelligence ooze away. I grew smaller. I was infantile. Then I was myself, this self, me, in blue jeans. And I was leading this creature, who had been me, along a path in a deep woods.
As we walked, occasionally we passed people who would comment on it. Strange animals came out of the bushes to sniff it. As evening came, I knew I was going to have to defend it. It was different. It was other. I knew that it was going to be attacked. And I climbed into the ruin of a large old building. I fought for a long time to keep it safe. Imagine swinging from rafters and clubs. But finally I was exhausted. And the animals who were attacking came closer and closer. And then I saw it. As it stood behind me, I realized it glowed in the dark. I knew this meant it was poison. It moved forward toward the attacking animals, and they shrank away. I knew the poison was its protection, and it would be okay, and I didn't have to fight for it anymore. What in the world? What is conceptualized there? How can I talk about self-images? Do I think of myself as a chubby, 2-foot-tall thing that glows in the dark? And it's poison. Not exactly. But it tells me about defiance. It tells me something about defiance. It tells me something about which battles need to be faced and which we have already won if we will only look at them. It tells me something about the essence of what we are as feminists, and especially as lesbians, that is seen by those who would destroy us as a threat, poison. And in that threat is our defense, yes, but also that which antagonizes. By being what we are, by speaking aloud, we come into immediate confrontation with the world around us. Certain things, if imagined and then spoken, deny us access to approved roles within our social sphere. As a self-spoken lesbian, I will never again be the same good girl I was when the approval of the fathers was possible for me, whether in my personal life, my professional, or my political life. Which brings me, I guess, to a basic disagreement with the title of this panel, which, as I realized as I listened to Mary and to Audrey speak, they had the same disagreement. I can't talk about language and action in a separate mode. Language for me is action. To speak words that have been unspoken, to imagine that which is unimaginable, is to create the place in which change or action occurs. I do believe our acts are limited ultimately only by what we fail or succeed in conceptualizing. To imagine a changed universe will not cause it to come into being. That is a more complicated affair. But to fail to imagine it, to fail to imagine a changed universe, the consequences of that are clear. If feminism is the final cause, and I believe it is, then language is its first necessity. The last speaker, Audrey Lynn Rich.
I feel that this panel is one part of a continuing non-linear meditation and colloquy. For me, it began, if I can assign a date, it began here in Chicago in 1971, what I believe was the first Women's Commission event, when Tilly Olson spoke of the forces that have stifled and muted women writers. And when not long after, in 1972, I believe, I first read Mary Daly's The Ungod the Father, in which she identified the great silence, which has buried the lives of individual women and of women as a group. It has gone on in private and public places, on paper and over the long-distance telephone, as I listened to tapes of Judith McDaniel, Susan Griffin, and other lesbian writers speaking at the San Francisco NLA in 1975, as I read in lavender ditto pages Julia Stanley's and Susan Robbins's papers on the politics of grammar and naming, as I read Dina Metzger on secrets, Alice Walker on the lost, illiterate black woman geniuses, Michelle Cliff on speechlessness, as I have talked with friends and with women newly met, as I've tried to probe the nature of my own life silences in journals, poems, and dreams. Last December, at that MLA panel that Julia has alluded to, Audrey and I and others took up yet again the question of naming and identity and the silences about black women and lesbians that still pervade the field of women's studies and the teaching of literature. So everything I say here has been touched in some way by many other women writers, thinkers, teachers, and students, without whose work my own would be impoverished. I want to focus this afternoon on silence as a crucial element in civilization. I would like to talk about namelessness, denial, secrets, taboo subjects, erasure, false naming, non-naming, encoding, omission, veiling, fragmentation, and lying. But because time is short, I will have only to speak those words in your ears, hoping that hearing the forms of silence named will keep you, will keep us all, alert for its presence, aware that silence has many presences. Most of all, I want to speak of how the unspoken, that which we are forbidden or dread to name and describe, becomes the unspeakable, as in the phrase, unspeakable acts. How the nameless becomes the invisible. And I'm going to try to suggest some thoughts to you about the acts of writing and teaching as a choice between collusion with silence or revolt against silence. One of the most recent voices that has entered this meditation and colloquy is an essay by Barbara Smith, toward a black feminist criticism, in the second issue of the magazine Conditions. Barbara read some parts of that essay in the session on black women writers earlier today. I urge all of you to get the magazine and read this essay. She writes of the interconnections between the violence committed by white racist culture against black women, the violence committed by homophobic culture against lesbians, the silences of literature and literary criticism, both on the part of black males and white feminists, that have erased the lives of black women and most utterly the lives of black lesbians. This essay addresses eloquently a silence that I believe imprisons all women, white or black, lesbian or heterosexual. In other words, I urge each of you to find and read it for her own sake, not for the sake of black or lesbian women. We cannot escape collusion with racism or homophobia simply by having humanistic intentions, by a desire to be politically liberal or well-informed, or in the belief that we are in revolt against silence for anyone's sake but our own. The mutual history of black and white women in this country is a realm so painful and so important that it has barely been touched by writers either of political so-called science or of imaginative literature. Yet until that silence is broken, that history revealed, every woman who calls herself feminist and anti-racist is struggling in a vacuum of deprivation under a bell jar of ignorance. As we push together the fragmented pieces of sexual and racial fear and violence that form the sexual and racial inhumanity of patriarchy, we begin to realize that our sexual integrity will never be won until we can lay claim to ourselves in all women and all women in ourselves. And we also begin to recognize that racism will never be expunged through blotting out, erasing the collective and individual intensities between women, black and white. I want to examine here, however briefly, the terms racism and homophobia, because they too seem to me to need redefining, and in the case of homophobia, renaming. The instrumentality of white women in the perpetration of inhumanity against black people is a fact of history. So also has been the instrumentality of women of the same race against each other or against their own children, the horizontal and downward-reaching violence of the impotent. White women have collaborated actively and passively with racism. Our brains and hearts have been poisoned by its fumes. The white women, like black women and black men, have lived from the founding of this country under a constitution drawn up and still interpreted by white men. And it is important for us to remember that, in spite of economic dependence on men, laws and customs forbidding women to speak in public, to vote, or to defy fathers, husbands, and brothers, white women, our foremothers and foresisters, have still, in Lillian Smith's words, been disloyal to civilization, smelled death in the word segregation, have often defied patriarchy for the first time, not on their own behalf, but on behalf of black men, women, and children. To understand that we have been not the creators of racism, but often its passive instruments, is not to deny or trivialize the nature of that instrumentality. It is, perhaps for the first time, to recognize and resolve to end it. The term homophobia, meaning the fear of same-sex, erotic, affectional feelings in oneself and in others, has become current of late. I suggest that it is an inadequate and misleading term where lesbians are concerned. What all women live under, what feminists and lesbians must consciously confront, is gynophobia, fear, hatred, a state of war against women. Poisonous fumes, which, like racism, are constantly breathed by all of us in this culture and in most other cultures on the planet. Violence against women, like violence against blacks, is condoned and, in the case of women, encouraged by pornography. Women, like blacks, are seen as needing to be controlled, as embodiments of the dark unconscious, inferior in intellectual capacity, marginal, eternally guilty. Throughout white Western literature and thought, from Aeschylus to Freud and into the present, runs the idea that civilization itself depends on the possession and control of women's sexuality by men, the civilizers. When women, black or white, agree to keep silence or to deny parts of ourselves in order to keep what privilege or respectability we are granted at that price, we are not only collaborating with gynophobia, we are helping to create the unspeakable. The past 10 years of feminists writing and speaking, saying our own words or attempting to, has shown us that it is the realities civilization tells us are regressive or unspeakable, which may turn out to be our deepest resources. Female anger, love between women, the tragic, potent bond between mother and daughter, the fact that a woman may rejoice in creating with her brain and not with her uterus, the actualities of lesbian motherhood, the sexuality of older women, the connections, painful, oblique, and often bitter, between black and white women, including guilt, manipulation, betrayal, contempt, hypocrisy, envy, rage, and love. If we have learned anything in our coming to language out of silence, it is that what has been kept unspoken, therefore unspeakable in us, is what is threatening to the patriarchal order in which men control first women, then all who can be defined and exploited as other. All silence has a meaning. In her Conditions article, Barbara Smith says that she would like to encourage in white women a sane accountability to all the women who live and write on this soil. Speaking as a white lesbian feminist, I would add that this accountability is not to some shadowy other, but to ourselves, all of us. Passive racism means that we passively consent to remain the instruments of the men who have always profited from colonialism, imperialism, slavery, enforced heterosexuality, organized prostitution, and pornography. And I would equally like to encourage in all women, black or white, who are teaching literature or writing it or writing about it, accountability to the lesbian in themselves, a commitment to hear her and give her space to speak for her, however stifled she may have become, however faint her voice or blurred her features. Accountability to lesbian experience, literature, and history is accountability to what has been unspoken and unspeakable. As writers, as scholars, as teachers, we have a choice to name or not to name. But non-naming is also action, the adding of yet another layer, our own, to the walls that entomb a part of the truth, a part of our freedom. Silence, denial, secrets, taboo, false naming, erasure, encoding, omission, veiling, non-naming, fragmentation, lying. Against this texture or tissue of the unspoken, what wonder if Emily Dickinson exhorted herself to tell all the truth but tell it slant? That the words of Phyllis Wheatley that come down to us give us only a ghost of her lifelong pain. Or that Gertrude Stein wrote that poetry is of naming something, of really naming that thing passionately, completely, passionately naming that thing by its name, yet that in Tender Buttons and on I struggled with the ridding myself of nouns. I knew nouns must go in poetry as they are gone in prose, if anything that is everything was to go on meaning something. If the noun or name for something is unspeakable and the writer is committed to her own meaning, she may, as Stein did, adopt desperate strategies. Like Virginia Woolf, she may elaborate in metaphor. I want you to figure to yourselves a girl sitting with a pen in her hand, which for minutes and indeed for hours she never dips into the ink pot. The image that comes to my mind when I think of this girl is the image of a fisherman lying sunk in dreams on the verge of a deep lake with a rod held out over the water. She was letting her imagination sweep unchecked round every rock and cranny of the world that lies submerged in the depth of our subconscious being. Now came the experience that I believe to be far commoner with women writers than with men. The line raced through the girl's fingers. Her imagination had rushed away. It had sought the pools, the depths, the dark places where the largest fish slumber. And then there was a smash. There was an explosion. There was foam and confusion. The imagination had dashed itself against something hard. The girl was roused from her dream. To speak without figure, and at last Wolf is able, however briefly, to do so. She had thought of something, something about the body, about the passions, which it was unfitting for her as a woman to say. Men, her reason told her, would be shocked. The consciousness of what men will say of a woman who speaks the truth about her passions had roused her from her artist's state of unconsciousness. She could write no more. Now, the passage I just read comes from Virginia Woolf's speech on professions for women, given before the London National Society for Women's Service in 1931. Rather, it is the version of that speech, revised by Leonard Woolf for a posthumous volume of essays, The Death of the Moth. If you examine the original version of that essay in the recently published volume, The Partitas, you discover, among other interesting variations, that Woolf originally wrote Fisherwoman, not Fisherman. That, as Ellen Hawks of Boston University notes in a review of The Partitas in Ms., Leonard Woolf smoothed over and toned down the anger and vehemence with which Woolf flailed at the conventions which circumscribed her and made so much of the woman writer's experience unspeakable. This kind of information matters because it helps us to understand not only Woolf's struggles with her truths, but our own struggles to pierce the silence, the impediments, such as false editing, false criticism, false interpretation, and false naming, that we confront as readers and teachers of literature and as writers even after we are dead. There is so much to be done. One major question on which feminist scholars still remain silent is the question of how institutionalized heterosexuality has served to buttress patriarchy, the control by men of women's minds, bodies, and energies. Heterofeminism is still not feminism in its wholeness, any more than a feminism which engages in passive racism is worthy the name. If in the study and teaching of literature we fail to listen for the silences underlying the poetry of heterosexual romance, if we are not attuned to the gaps in language, the unwritten scenes and absent characters of the novel, the encoded messages in the writing actually before us, we are failing as scholars and educators in the task of bringing to light, rescuing from oblivion, exposing both the limits and the untouched possibilities of literature. I want to end by reading two poems. The first was written by Emily Dickinson at the age of 49, 7 years before her death, and 11 years after she had written Tell All the Truth, But Tell It Slant. A counterfeit, a plated person, I would not be. Whatever strata of iniquity my nature underlie. Truth is good health and safety and the sky. How meager, what an exile is alive and vocal when we die. The second is part of a long poem by Stephanie Bird, 25-year-old black lesbian poet, which I found in the first volume of her poetry entitled 25 Years of Malcontent. It's called Quarter of a Century. I'll never know my real naming, never know its origin. What would you call this high yellow born into an uncertainty and schizophrenia, born into a place where I have no say? I live with the ghosts of slaves whose blood still colors my dreams. What would you call me, me whose name is Jigaboo and Nigger? My body aches from unseen beatings. I cry tears of blood. I work tilling a field of my brothers and sisters' bleeding bodies, and all the while searching for a naming. What would you call me, black woman, who has sought naming in strange women's breasts and between their legs? What is it that you call me, who pays homage to heathen gods and decorates the family tree with nightmares? Is there no naming for this child's soil who stands before you now? Bones say, seek my naming in the east. Swollen, cracked lips tell me to turn home. Grandmothers warn me to turn away the alien ways of what is white. But when these things are connected, winding serpentine in hieroglyphs and language, a name, love,